And the topic is really about how do we bring grace, you know, into this really toxic culture where we just don't show grace to people, where it is like, you know, oh, you did something 5 years ago, we're going to like ruin your life over it.
Yeah.
Even if you've changed your position or you're sorry or, you know, and then often it's 20 years ago. I mean, it's crazy.
The power of those who identify and translate and communicate current events is truly massive, sometimes frighteningly so. In 1978, science fiction writer Philip K. Dick warned against the power of what he called the media, writing, "I distrust their power, they have a lot of it." And it's an astonishing power, that of creating whole universes, universes of the mind. I think that's a fair warning. At the same time, I also think that entities like Fox and CNN, the New York Times, USA Today are inextricable from American culture. They're not going anywhere. Well, sure, the names will change, but there will also be, and always be, centralized sources whose role and responsibility is to identify, translate, and communicate current events. So the question for me becomes, what kind of person do I trust with that kind of influence? Kirsten Powers has been and continues to be that kind of person. Author Jonathan Merritt once described her as that feisty, funny commentator on CNN, and she certainly is that. She also has a keen eye for nuance in otherwise two-dimensional news stories and a practice of self-examination the likes of which I rarely see in any kind of public figure. She is a journalist, an author, and a podcaster. She is also my guest on this episode of the Etsy Podcast. Check it out. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Nashville right now.
Which is not home for you, at least not original home, because you're from Alaska.
That's right, yeah. But I live now. Is this the interview now?
We're going to talk.
Oh, we're in. Okay, great. Perfect, yeah. Alaska is my original home, though I haven't lived there since... You know, I was 18 and I left for college. So I live in D.C. right now.
Yeah.
But I'm in Nashville just visiting friends and doing interviews for this podcast that I'm launching in mid-October.
Do you still consider yourself Alaskan? Like when you like in the depths of your person, you are an Alaskan.
Yeah, totally.
What does that mean for you to consider yourself an Alaskan? Do you see politics? Do you see news? Do you see America in a particular way because you're an Alaskan? Like, how does it impact your work, your outlook? Is that part of the kind of being you in the world as being an Alaskan, and how does that play out?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a very kind of, you know, frontier spirit there, very independent minded spirit, at least when I was growing up.
Right.
So I think that I do think it contributes to the fact that I don't tend to fit into any box.
Okay.
You know, I'm not just like, oh, I'm, you know, signed onto this ideology or this political party, and I'm just going to always say or think what, you know, they're saying and thinking.
Yeah.
I feel very, you know, sort of removed from that. And I think that, you know, when I was growing up in Alaska, I was growing up in the 70s. It was pre-internet, pre-cable news.
Hmm.
We only got two of the networks. You know, they had to like literally mail the reels, you know what I'm saying? So
right.
Our news was like a day late. Like it was almost like not growing up in the United States. It was just so isolated. It just was a very unique childhood. And I feel that it was a very, I'm so thankful I wasn't a child now.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, even in Fairbanks, because even I, you know, with my nieces, they're exposed to so much through the fact that they have access to the internet and cable news.
Yeah.
And it's not you don't feel that remove anymore. And of course, air travel also is so commonplace now. Whereas when I was growing up, you know, flying on a plane was like a big deal.
And you wore like, a collar and the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you like get dressed up, and it wasn't like you just like, oh, I'm hopping on this plane and flying down to Seattle for a concert, right?
Exactly.
Like that didn't happen. Now it's like, you know, my nieces, they're always traveling. I mean, they're little, they're 10 and 8, but they're always traveling. They've been all over, you know, everywhere. Like they've lived like a life that, you know, I still haven't lived.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Like every time I'm like, they get back from some other vacation, some insane thing, I'm like, you do understand, like, your life will never get better than this. Like, this
you've peaked.
Incredible.
I'm sorry to tell you, you've peaked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they're always laughing. They're like, yeah, we know.
Well, I've been to Alaska twice, and the very first time we were there, it was like later October, November, and so the sun was, you know, rising around 10:30 or 11 in the morning and setting at like 2 or 3, which is very disorienting. And yep. And the people I was staying with, they showed me my room, and then they pointed out that I said, hey, thanks for letting me stay here. They're like, well, you're really fortunate because we have someone new in the house. I said, oh, really? So wait, hold on. This is someone else's room. I said, yeah, but he can't come in yet. And they had this whole policy, which is so I understand now is somewhat Alaskan. They had this whole policy that this person who was going to live there long term had to kill something larger than him before he could live in the house. Like, and so they pointed out into the wilderness behind the house, and there was a tent out there, and they're like, he's out there and he can come in once he's killed something bigger than him. I was like, I'm eventually will leave and go back to Northern California, but thank you for having me for the time period that I'm here. That seems like this, like, is that, I mean, it's like an Alaskan, like, frontier, this is how the world works kind of a thing.
I think they might have been like jerking your leg a little bit.
Okay, good.
I've never heard of that. So I think they were probably having fun with the Californian.
Well, yeah, that's often at my expense. So coming from there, living in DC, does holding to that kind of frontier-ish mindset make it easier to call DC home, or do you consider DC home? Do you think in terms of home, or is it just that?
I don't.
No, mm-hmm. Really?
No. I mean, if you were to ask me, what's your home? I'd still say Alaska, even though I haven't lived there in, you know, 20 plus years.
Is that more so because of because of your history, or because there's something about DC that won't let you root?
I mean, it is hard to have roots in DC. That's true. I've lived either in DC or New York City for my entire adult life. Hmm. And so I spent, you know, about 10 years in New York. And I think when I was in New York, I felt like New York was home. I still would have said Alaska was my home. But I did feel very connected, to New York, in a way that I don't to DC. And I don't, I've just never loved DC as a city. There are great people there and I have great friends. But I'm there for work.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't need to be there for work, I don't think I would be there. And I think my fiance feels the same way. You know, he's a journalist also. And, you know, so there's tons of interesting people, but I don't know. I think a lot of it is people move a lot. It's not a place that people have other places. It's pretty commonplace. Like if you ask somebody where home is in DC, a lot of times it's not DC, even though they lived there for 30 years. Right. Yeah. You know, it's, so a lot of transplants, a lot of people, you know, coming in and out. And so, but I just have never connected with it as a place, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like even though I think I like the people, it's not, like in New York City, I could not know a single person and I would still be happy, if that makes sense. Like, I love the city. It just makes me happy. I love walking around. I love, you know, it's just, and with DC, it's the only thing I like about it is that I have like really great, interesting friends.
Yeah. The thing is about like living online, I'd love to spend some time here because you've had a really interesting journey and like I would say like a kind of a like a culturally revelatory journey for a lot of folks. Is some of your clarity about living online has been helpful for others as well. Do you like, are you sort of settled there with like Twitter, or there are certain places online that just are as a place not helpful, and if you need to be there, but don't stay? Like, is that how you, is that kind of your take now, or how do you feel about living online now?
I think I find Twitter completely toxic, and it, and I also, there's something about it that brings out the worst in people, and that includes me. And I'm sure there's some brain scientist who could explain it to you, but there is absolutely something where you just see people that you've known for a long time, and you're like, "What are you doing?"
Hmm.
You know, and I'm sure people have looked at me and said the same thing.
Right.
And I know I've looked back and been like, "What was that?" You know, it's just something about it that just really can bring out like things I would never say in person.
Right.
I would never even say on television, you know, even in a heated debate, I wouldn't say. So, yeah, for me, I realized. And the other thing I noticed was I've never been like there are certain people who are like on Twitter all the time.
Right.
You know
what
I mean? Like they're just always on it, and they've been on it for years and years and years. I was never that person. I was always somebody who kind of would, when something was happening, right? The Kavanaugh hearings or something, you know, something then you start getting, where there's a lot happening and you want to follow. And so I would kind of do it like that, and I'd kind of dip in and out. And what I found was I would notice like almost within 24 hours, I would start in my real life becoming more agitated.
Hmm.
I would become less patient, more irritable, less happy. And so I think I ultimately just decided, like, it's just, you know, I go on now and then. I kind of, you know, whatever. I mean, but I'm not usually on it for more than, like, five minutes or something. I just, the snark, the nastiness, the kind of glee at taking people down.
Yeah.
You know, that's another thing that you see a lot, you know, people really dragging people and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, ooh.
Yeah.
So I've become more of an Instagrammer.
Yeah. It's a slightly safer place.
It's like an alternate universe. Yeah, it's more normal. It's like people are nice.
Yeah.
They just want to see pictures of your dog.
Yes, they do. A piece earlier in the year, and I don't know if you're tired of talking about it, because then it carried quite a bit of weight for folks. But you wrote a piece about changing your mind about how you wanted to approach living online. And if you mind, I'm going to read this line from here and ask you to elaborate in a little bit. But you wrote, because this is a fascinating element to me. You said, as I surveyed my work, the thing that struck me, by surveying your work, you took a look at how you lived online, specifically on Twitter, and you said, as I surveyed my work, the thing that struck me is how much I've changed. I'm not the same person I was a year ago, let alone 25 years ago. Yet our media, and I love that you use the word our media instead of the media, our media routinely dig up information from decades ago and demands judgment be delivered with no regard to whether the person has evolved. And one would figure or think just – or I would figure and think that like with the pace of change culturally, that those would be spaces that were more fluid, that who you were online on Facebook now or on Twitter now, there would be a natural sense of, hey, this, you know, the platform's changed four times in the last week, so why don't people – but there really is this sort of like static, stuck in the mud, you are who you were thing.
Mm-hmm.
Living online, you found something else, like that it was a matter of like you had changed, but the platform wasn't letting you be someone different now. Can you talk a little bit more about like what you saw?
Yeah, though I wasn't just talking about Twitter. I was actually looking also at my columns and you know, my interactions online and, you know, and just the positions that I had held and that I had felt very strongly about that now I don't feel that strongly about, or I maybe even think differently about. Hmm. And I think that there's a couple of things. One thing I would say, like, just in the journalism world today, and it's been this way for quite some time, at least the last decade, where you're really asked to, like, this instant analysis, right? You know, so you're always, like, having to take, like, a hard line position on something, like, instantaneously. You don't really have time to sit and ponder it and, like, talk it through with people. You know, something happens and my editor's like, I want to call him now, you know? Mm. And so you, like, bang it out and, you know, it has to be done within, you know, by the next day at the latest, which is like a million years, you know? And so I don't think it, you know, so I do some things I'd look back and I'd be like, I don't really know if I agree with that. And actually I don't love my tone there.
Yeah.
You know, and so so I think that's some of it, but I also think that, and also I'm not tired of talking about this because I'm actually working on a book proposal about this topic right now.
Yeah.
So I've been spending a lot of time, you know, as ago. I mean, it's crazy. You know, I mean, I see people who did stuff when they were in high school, you know, getting in trouble. I mean, it happened to a New York Times editor recently, you know, who had, it was bad stuff. I mean, there's no question, but he was like in high school,
right?
You know, and it's just, are people not allowed to change or be different? I mean, isn't that the whole point of, you know, advocating, you know, against racism, against misogyny, against homophobia, against all these things? Isn't the whole point is that you want people to change? I mean, sometimes it seems like no.
Right. Well, see, I mean, it's easier to just.
When they change, it's just like, no, I don't want to let you change. I want to punish you for what you used to think and what you said. And it's just like, what?
Yeah.
So I think that at the same time, it's very hard in this culture to show grace to people because we're all like at this pitched fever of, you know, just everybody's so mad at each other. Everybody's so outraged, you know, all the time. It's like, how do you step back and say, like, you know, okay, I'm going to show other people this type of grace that I would like to be shown. And I think that's another thing that when I'm watching these people online, really gleefully dragging people, it's like, do you really think this is never going to happen to you?
Yeah.
Do you really think you're so perfect that you have never made a mistake? Or that you never will make a mistake, because at some point you're going to need somebody to show some grace to you.
Yeah. How long have you been working on the book? I know you're putting a proposal now. You're working on, do you have a working title? Like, tell me a little bit about the book and like where you're at with it. And is your process that you've got stuff that's been kind of collected and now you're assembling? How's that work?
Yeah. Well, no, I have a proposal that I did and basically I'm just finishing it up now because my agents, you know, basically thought it was a great proposal, but I wasn't. It was more me like being journalistic, like reporting on it, sort of like, this is what so-and-so says about it. And this is what so-and-so says about it. And he's like, no, I want to know what you say about it.
Yeah.
Like, I want to know what it's like for you when you're, you know, sitting in front of millions of people having, you know, this battle, you know, what are you feeling? What's it like when you walk off the set? How do you, you know, like that kind of, those kinds of experiences. And so that's been really hard. To
make it personal.
To make it personal. It's easier to write about other people. The other thing is, it's also very hard to go back and have this even deeper reckoning over some of the things that I've done, you know, and or felt. You know, sometimes it's not even what I did. It's more what I was feeling and thinking. And I think, like, as a Christian, it really is contrary to what I say I believe, you know, where I really do believe, like, you know, I should have grace for other people. I should, you know, see God in everybody. And I can tell you, like, especially during the Trump era, that really has not always been the case.
No, it's considerably harder.
So really having to, like, think about that, write about it, and that's been really hard. So I'm pretty close to, getting that done. We haven't figured out the title or any of that kind of stuff. So, and then, I have to sell the book, but, that's kind of where that is, but it's been, a not fun process for me to kind of go, oh, that wasn't very, I'm not super proud of that.
Right. Now, on that same note, a lot of your work, the line between, because writing about other people is easier. I suppose depending on who that is, maybe that's different. But like a lot of your work and the line between what's work and journalism and what's personal for you, you end up living online as a full human. How should I say this? Like, there's a decent portion of your life that takes place in public that like other journalists won't necessarily have like crossed into. So like. 2018, you recounted like your own sexual assault in the light of Dr. Ford's testimony, and you wrote this very personal piece, and then you were you talked with Anderson Cooper online about, and then recounted the thing again in 2017. Like before that, you talked about working in another news network and dealing with sexual harassment. The living online, the living in public, not even online, living in public that way, that personally, and sharing those kinds of personal experiences, like you said, it's more difficult writing a book in that direction. Is that how do you experience that as a person? Is that like a privilege? Is it a burden? Is it kind of a mix of both? Is it one of those like terrible privileges that comes with, having a public position? Like, how do you actually experience that? As a person.
That's interesting. I've never really thought about it that way. I mean, I think it probably is a privilege. It's also very hard for me. So I also wrote a column around, Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade's suicide, where I talked about being suicidal after my father died.
Yes, ma'am.
And so there are these like series of columns I've done basically in the last year to a year and a half. And they're actually a direct result of, I don't know if you ever read Brené Brown.
Yes, ma'am.
I've read a lot of her stuff, but I did read her most recent book on leadership. And, basically saying like, you really can't be in a position of leadership if you can't be an effective leader unless you're willing to be vulnerable. And that's really what people need from you. And so I made a really conscious decision to be vulnerable and basically sort of felt like, what's the point of doing what I'm doing and having the platform that I have if I'm not going to talk about these things? And so I think, it was scary, definitely scary to do these things. And I wrote another one somewhat recently. I mean, I can't remember, maybe 2 or 3 months ago about abortion.
Yes, ma'am.
And about how my views on abortion have evolved. And when you write these things, you're thinking, oh, people are going to be, well, why did you realize this before? Or why were you blah, blah, blah? And actually, you know what? I was really amazed at like the grace that was shown to me. Where people were saying, thank you for rethinking things and being willing to admit you were wrong, because people don't do that. And so that's not to say I didn't get nastiness. Of course, you always get nastiness. but I think, every time I do it, it gets a little less scary, but there is always that moment of, I'm doing this and I don't know what's going to happen. And I feel kind of exposed and kind of naked.
Yeah.
But at the same time, those are the columns that have resonated the most with people. I mean, my suicide column got well over 1 million, page views or whatever. And was like the most read column on USA Today for like a week. And, you know, and I've had so many, you know, other journalists who emailed me and who said, you know, they wrote about their depression after reading it. And so you start to realize, like, these are the things that really impact people much more than my analysis on, you know, whatever the news of the day is. It's just, you know, that this is kind of what people really, I think these are the conversations we need to be having.
Yeah.
So it's meaningful and it's worthwhile, but it's not, it really doesn't get easy. And even like I said, when I think of this book, I get kind of nauseous. You know, it's just, I'm like, I know I need to do this and I know it's the right thing to do. But it's just like, I don't want to do it.
Yeah. And some would say, I mean, some coaches, you know, creative coaches and other folks, I think Brené Brown would probably say the same thing. And Seth Godin would certainly say the same thing, is if it scares you a little bit, that might be an indication you're on the right thing. You know, professionally, yeah. Vocationally, like that fear might come with like, yeah, you're sort of stepping into that place. Like for you then, yeah. Do you have particular practices that then that you go to stay healthy, to stay grounded? I know, you know, earlier on in the year, like right around the time you were you'd been writing about, you know, toxicity online and relationship, you reread what's the Philip Yancey book, What's So Amazing About Grace. It's such a great book. Are there particular things you go to for grounding? Are there practices you have that keep you healthy? Like sort of like personal liturgies that hold you?
Definitely. And I think when I look back on a lot of the times where I'm like, oh, I don't really like what I did, it was because I wasn't engaging in those practices. I think it's so important to be really making it a priority and making the time to stay grounded. And then when I do that, I'm much less likely to act out or say something snarky or whatever. And so things as simple as exercising, you know, really, I mean, making it a priority. I do a lot of yoga. You know, it's kind of become non-negotiable to me now. Whereas before it would be like, oh, I'm, you know, yeah, I'll work out if I have time or whatever. I schedule everything around it. I schedule my TV hits around it. I look at my calendar and I'm like, okay, when am I doing my yoga today? I meditate every day, twice a day for 20 minutes. I pray all the time. I do expressive writing. I don't know if you know anything about that, but like that's, you know, basically you just first thing in the morning, you just write like everything that comes into your head and then you like rip it up. And there's all this science on how it really helps your brain kind of offload stuff. You know, like
I would have the hardest time tearing that thing up.
I know sometimes, but the thing is, if you're really doing it right, often it's totally inane. You know, because a lot of the stuff that's coming into your brain is just like, just random, you know what I mean? So it's, so I do stuff like that. And so I really try to, and when I'm doing all of that, I feel pretty grounded, you know, and then making time to, you know, be with my friends and, you know, stay connected and that kind of stuff. And I find, interestingly, I think one of the most interesting things about it is, you know, we live in this like hustle and grind culture.
Yeah.
And it's actually counterproductive. So this like, I'm just going to work all the time. I'm just going to grind, push, 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 push. And it's like, I have found actually when I have just set aside this time to take care of myself, I'm a million times more productive. Yeah. I'm more successful.
Yeah.
It's like, it's actually the opposite. You know, it's not like it's the opposite of what we're sort of taught in this sort of American way of life.
Yes. Yeah. It's that odd, mysterious sort of Sabbath principle that if you would set aside all this time, I promise you I'll take care of you. Like if you pull 52 days a week off the calendar, that seems absolutely berserk to not work these days, I promise you,
yeah,
like there will be fruit on the other side of it. Can you, I know we've got a drop dead time here in about a minute. The podcast that launches in October it's called How to Do You. What was the impetus? Mm-hmm. What made you want to go towards the podcast? What can we expect once we get there?
Yeah, this idea came to me. It's not political. It's, you know, purely inspirational encouragement. And I think, you know, the thing, it came to me because I had a long-term chronic illness. I'd had chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and, you know, anxiety and all these things. And I kind of follow, you know, there's just a million people telling you, right? Be paleo, be vegan, follow this spiritual guru, follow this religious teacher, you know, do this meditation. No, do this one. You know, it's just this constant, like, you have to do this kind of diet if you want to feel good. And I tried everything. And it, ultimately, I didn't really start to see healing until I started to just listen to myself and really learn how to just be myself.
Mm.
And one of the things that was really integral, and that was the Enneagram, which, are you an Enneagram person?
I know some things.
Okay. So the Enneagram, for people who don't know, it's the personality typing system. And it's just, for me, just explained a lot. And it helped me kind of, I guess, make peace with myself. Because my type, I'm an 8, which is... the challenger, and for women who are that type, it can be very difficult. And so understanding that, because our culture kind of shames opinionated, you know, women who are like too big, it's less so that way now, but it really, when I was growing up, was very much that way.
Yeah.
And so I kept like kind of contracting and getting smaller. And so of course I got sick. And I, you know, starting to realize like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. This is actually how God made me. And like, God doesn't make junk. So why don't I just lean into this?
That's strong.
And so, yeah. And so to me, it was like, oh, I just really was about learning to be myself. And then I've noticed just, you know, I mentor a lot of people, and I just noticed there's a lot of this, like, I don't know how to do life. You know, like, it's just, people just feel, and so I want to interview people who can help people navigate that.
That's really good.
Help them learn to really, like, you know, love themselves and tap into their intuition and take care of themselves and, you know, to live a more like connected life.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for making the time this morning. Sincerely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think I mentioned this over email, but in all honesty, like, legitimately, in the wake of the 2016 election, which was this weird, dark watershed moment for a lot of us, as a person of faith who's a more left-leaning Democrat, looking for language and clarity and not even just level-headedness, but thoughtfulness and intentionality in perceiving and understanding and receiving just the pure news, you have been a great guide and a great help. And so I can only imagine that what you're going to do with the podcast will continue in that direction for a lot of folks who need to figure that out for themselves in a different capacity. So thanks for your incredible work.
Well,
I look forward to what you do next. Absolutely.
All right.
Thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the At Sea Podcast. If you'd like to keep track of Kirsten Powers and any of the work she's doing, one route would be to go to her website, which is just her name.com. So KirstenPowers.com. The new podcast, which launches in October, is called How to Do You. And probably the best way to keep track of that would be to find it at Instagram. So her feed is just Kirsten Powers at Kirsten Powers on Instagram. And the show is How to Do You Show on Instagram.
And if you'd like to keep track of this podcast, you can just find me online. My name is Justin McRoberts. You can search me on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, or you can just jump to Patreon. And not just pay attention to and know what's coming up next with the At Sea podcast, but you can become part of the community that is shaping this podcast as it is and into the future. Patreon.com, Justin McRoberts. We'd love to have you on the team. Until next time.